On the day we left Bailey on our return trip, we were told by the police interpreter that a native from Cape Bathurst was leaving the same day for Horton River. So, rather than take a chance on missing the cutoff again, we decided to travel with him from Whale Bluff. He was going to Horton River, all right, but what we didn't know at the time, he intended to follow his usual route, which was over his trap line. At one time, we were 20 miles inland instead of following the bluffs. However, it was smooth going, the weather was nice, and we finally arrived at Horton River in good order. After spending a day visiting with Patsy Wyant, we started on the last leg of the trip home. It was the end of March, usually the coldest month of the year, but this was perfect. The days were long, the sun was high, and the dogs, knowing they were getting close to home, traveled at a good pace with no urging needed. This was northern travel at its best, and believe it or not, we were a little sorry when we arrived home at Langdon Bay. With all the major patrols taken care of, the month of April gave us a chance to relax a bit. The dogs were kept in shape in case they would be needed for a quick trip. We hauled ice from the lake, fished from Tomcod Bay, and occasional sweeps inland for ptarmigan. In May, things started to liven up. The weather started to improve, and with the sun overhead 24 hours a day, we were kept on the jump. Our favorite sport now was seal hunting. By making daily sweeps out over the ice in Franklin Bay, we kept the cook supplied with fresh meat. Some people don't care for seal meat, which when fried is as black as coal, but I never met anyone who didn't enjoy a nice feed of fresh seal liver. About the middle of May, we took a trip to Tomcod Bay to break up the fish camp and bring in the gear. Pete Strandberg, a trapper who had wintered near the ship, asked us to keep an eye open for a watch, which he thought he had lost on the portage near Tomcod Bay. Sure enough, on the portage, we found it. This is unbelievable. Alongside the trail, sitting on top of a snow pinnacle about a foot in height, was the watch. With the sun directly overhead, the surrounding snow settled, but the little snow pinnacle, protected from the sun's rays by the watch, had remained intact. We picked up the watch, wound it up, and it started working immediately. Getting close to the end of May, first signs of water started to show on the ice close to the ship. This was the signal to start cutting the stern clear. And whilst half the crew were engaged with this, the remainder started removing the winter housing. Everything as it was removed was numbered, starting from the bow, as well as a daub of red or green paint for port or starboard. Then all winter gear was stored below. Then the coal and the heavy gear we had moved ashore to lighten ship was brought back aboard. We were very pleased to note that the 30 ton of soft coal in bulk we had put ashore in the fall when the St. Rock was driven on the beach had diminished considerably during the 9 months we were frozen in. On June the 1st, the Black Gang started overhauling all the machinery. There were considerable repairs to the deck gear. Both the winch and the windlass had been damaged in getting the vessel off the beach. The main engine and the auxiliaries were given a thorough overhaul, and everything was finished well before the breakup deadline. The deck crew were lucky enough to get the hull painted before the ice started to candle. Walking over a stretch of candle ice is quite an experience. The first time I tried it, it scared the hell out of me. Imagine millions of candles made of ice standing on end, packed close together. They are usually about a foot in height. You step on them and they start to crumble. And you can't help thinking, am I going down a foot or all the way through? If you were unfortunate enough to be coming home late from a patrol, your dog sure take a beating, as the candle ice not only cuts their pads, but cuts their legs to ribbons. We always carried a number of dog moccasins made from moose hide or canvas, but when these are worn out, the dogs have a tough time of it. They know they have to get home and will stay on their feet as long as possible. When they lay down, it's time to take them on the sled. Sometimes it's a toss-up whether the dogs bring you home or whether you pull the sled yourself. The crew also managed to get most of their painting finished before the mosquitoes became too numerous. It's quite a sight to see the boys painting away on a hot day, wearing gloves and a head net, cursing like a trooper because they can't smoke for fear of setting the mosquito head net alight. With the first signs of water forming on the ice, the dogs were moved ashore. When the ice became too dangerous to travel back and forth, we put a man ashore to look after them. One of his chores was to smear grease on the nostrils, eyes, and ears of each dog every evening after feeding, as the mosquitoes just about drive them crazy. I don't think there's a spot on Earth that breeds more bloodthirsty mosquitoes than the Arctic coast. The natives call them kikiaks. With patches of open water beginning to show, the ducks and geese started arriving in large numbers. In a short time, they were there by the thousands. Talk about noise. For the first week or so, it was difficult to get any sleep at all. However, they say you can get used to anything. The ice moved out of Langdon Bay on the 9th of July. And after bringing the dogs and all the equipment from the Sandspit aboard, we left for Herschel on the 11th, stopping at Bailey Island to pick up Parslow en route. We arrived at Herschel Island on the 14th, where we laid at anchor waiting the arrival of the Bay Chimo from Vancouver with the next year's supplies. During this time, the first plane ever to reach Herschel Island arrived, a Dominion Explorer's Puss Moth, piloted by a chap named McMillan, sat down in the bay on August the 10th. The natives treated it as an everyday event. Some of them had never seen a plane before. They just referred to it as a tingmiak, which means big bird. The Bay Chimo arrived on the 12th, and we immediately moved in alongside of her for the transfer of supplies. Due to the fact that the deck machinery had proven too light for the type of work it had been called upon to perform, we received instructions to proceed to Vancouver after delivering the yearly supplies to the coast detachments. It was a good ice year, and the trip to Cambridge Bay and return to Herschel was routine and without incident. At Herschel, we took on water ballast for the trip outside. As the vessel is not equipped with ballast tanks, it was necessary to fill our empty fuel drums with water and stow them in the hold. Leaving Herschel on September the 1st, the St. Rock was fortunate in encountering no ice at Point Barrow, and it looked as if all our troubles were behind us. They were until we poked our nose through the Unimak Pass and out of the North Pacific. We ran into a three-day blow that was the equal, if not worse, than anything we had thrown at us in the Arctic. For 3 days, we didn't make an inch. We just held our own and crabbed along the coast. When the blow finally quit, we were 70 miles off our course. The remainder of the voyage was uneventful and very much enjoyed by all aboard. The only event worth mentioning was on the trip down the Inside Passage. We missed the tide at Seymour Narrows and went through broadside. But after what we had been through in the north, it wasn't even noticed. We arrived at Vancouver on September the 23rd, 1929, and after discharging our cargo of oil drums at the home oil dock, the St. Roch proceeded to the Burrard dry dock, where she tied up for the winter, to be refitted in the spring for her next trip to the north. It was here that I left the St. Roch for a while. As a matter of fact, the next time I saw her was at Herschel Island during the summer of 1932, at which time I rejoined the vessel after a voyage to the Eastern Arctic and a trip down the Mackenzie River. Although I was to spend quite a few years aboard the St. Roch and saw her pull herself out of some sticky situations, when I sit back now and think about her, some of the things that happened on the maiden voyage with her green crew aboard are the things most readily remembered. On May the 4th, 1930, I left Vancouver bound for the Eastern Arctic. On arriving in Ottawa, there was a slight delay whilst the draft for the various detachments was being assembled. 8 men, myself included, were ordered to report at the Dominion Observatory at Toronto for a 10-day meteorological course. This work was undertaken by the police to furnish the H.G. Watkins party, which had left England on the quest for a year's study of conditions in Greenland and Iceland, with information pertaining to the Canadian end of the England to Canada air route. These observations, taken 3 times daily, were to include maximum and minimum temperature and barometer readings, do theodolite and balloon work, and keep records of rain and snowfall, study and tabulate cloud formations, wind velocity, and visibility. An advance party was sent to North Sydney to check detachment supplies going aboard the Newfoundland sealer Beothuk, which had been chartered by the Department of the Interior's Northwest Territories branch for the 1930 expedition into the Eastern Arctic. The commander of the expedition was George P. Mackenzie, who at one time had been gold commissioner for the Yukon. Some of us were lucky enough to wangle a few days' leave, and I was able to spend a few days with my parents at Fredericton, New Brunswick, whom I had not seen for 11 years before reporting at North Sydney. By the 25th of July, we were all assembled and ready to go. Accompanying the expedition were 2 artists, A.Y. Jackson and L. Harris, who were to paint northern scenes for the Canadian government. Also aboard was Dr. Porcel, the scientist who represents the Danish government in the administration of Greenland. He was on his way to Godhaven on Disko Island, the capital of northern Greenland. With Corporal H.W. Stallworthy, I had been assigned to Bash Peninsula Detachment on Ellesmere Island, which at that time was the farthest north post in the world, latitude 79 degrees 4 minutes, 668 miles from the North Pole. We sailed from North Sydney July the 30th, 1930, through the Gulf of St. Lawrence and the Straits of Belle Isle, along the coast of Labrador, and then cut across to the southern tip of Greenland. At times, if conditions are right when making this crossing, a change in color can be noted in the water, a greenish tinge from the north turning to blue to the south. We encountered rough weather in Baffin Bay, but made good progress, arriving at Godhaven on Disko Island on August the 6th. Dr. Porcild went ashore, and we were given permission to land. No one is allowed on Greenland without the permission of the Danish government. There are no free traders, all trading posts being operated by the government. After a few hours ashore to stretch our legs, we again headed north. We hugged the Greenland coast, as it had been ascertained that the Melville Ice Pack, which is usually in the central portion of Baffin Bay, was well offshore. Two stops were made, one at Robinson Bay and one at Thule. Thule, now the site of a gigantic U.S. air base, was at that time, except for two tiny prefab shacks transported from Denmark on the shore, just about the most desolate spots you could find anywhere on Earth. On arriving at Eta, Greenland's most northerly inhabited point, we swung across Smith Sound to Cape Sabine, bucking heavy ice all the way, through Rice Straits and hove to at Fram Haven, where the three members of Bass Detachment who were being relieved had crossed Buchanan Bay in a whale boat and were awaiting our arrival. After a short consultation on ice conditions in general, it was decided to make a try to force our way through the heavily packed ice to the post. After working ice for a day, we were within 10 miles of the detachment, but increasing ice pressure forced us to turn back. We anchored behind Cocked Hat Island till the pressure eased. On the next attempt, we reached Alexandra Fjord, still about 10 miles from home, or what was to be our home if we ever made it. As the ice was packed solid in front of us, it was decided to land some of the heavier supplies at Cape Alexandra. Drums of gasoline and kerosene and about 20 tons of coal were cached at this point. By August the 16th, it was apparent the vessel would be unable to cross to the Bass Detachment under existing conditions. So the attempt was abandoned and the Beothuk returned to Fram Haven. All remaining supplies were landed there. As soon as the operation was completed, the Beothuk left immediately for Winter Harbor on Melville Island. The purpose of this patrol was to reprovision the cache established by the CGS Arctic around 1908. The vessel would then proceed down the coast of Baffinland, landing men and supplies at the various posts. As soon as the Beothuk left, Stahl and myself, along with our Greenland Eskimo, Nukapingwa, loaded all the perishables we could into the whaleboat and started our first trip for the post. By working the tides and taking advantage of any small leads that opened up, we made the 35 mile in just over a day. After unloading, we slept for 4 hours and then, with two dories in tow, started once more for Fram Haven. About 15 miles from the detachment, we saw three wallers sleeping on a large ice pan. The whale boat was powered with a Model T Ford engine and made very little noise. And by holding a piece of board over the exhaust, we were able to get within range without disturbing them. Stahl was at the tiller, and Nukapingwa and myself were in the bow with our rifles. With the engine idling, we decided to get as close as possible. We were about 25 feet away from the pan before one of the walruses lifted his head. Luckily, it was the one in the middle and he was facing the other way. The two outside were facing us. By arrangement, when Stahl gave the word, the Eskimo and myself would put one round into each of the outside walrus. Both of us would then fire at the one in the middle. It worked like a charm. We bagged the three of them with a total expenditure of 4 rounds of ammunition. One thing you learn early in this game, never try to kill a walrus with a headshot. You always shoot for the neck. The following spring during a hunt, a walrus surfaced about 3 feet from our whaleboat. I shot him right between the eyes with a .303 British high velocity. The bullet snapped his head back just enough for me to put a finishing shot in the neck. Our Eskimo hunter drove in a harpoon, otherwise we'd have lost him. As when killed, they sink immediately. After we got a line on the carcass and towed him ashore, I decided to find out what had happened to the bullet I had put in his head. The skull was over 4 inches of solid bone, and the bullet had penetrated halfway. Walrus have been known to crash up through 3 or 4 inches of sea ice to obtain air when caught by a quick freeze-up. This only happens on rare occasions, as they usually move out of the fjords and into the larger bays before freeze-up, where there's usually open water to be found. Now to get back to our three walrus on the ice pan. We now had close to 3 tons of valuable dog feed, and we had to get it to a safe place. We cut up one carcass and put the meat in the dories. As soon as the walrus was opened up, Nukupingwa examined the stomach and seemed quite pleased with what he found inside. The stomach was full of clams, and by picking them over, he filled a tea belly with fresh ones that the stomach juices hadn't started to work on. The walrus apparently had been feeding a very short time before we discovered them. They sleep soundly on a full tummy, which is probably why we were able to get so close to them. We then put lines on the remaining two and towed them off the ice pan, tying one on each side of the whaleboat. We headed for a small island about 5 miles closer to the post. As it was high tide, we beached them there and decided to have a meal whilst waiting for the tide to drop. We started up 2 Primus stoves. On one went the clams and a big feed of walrus heart on the other. We were a little dubious about the clams, but on tasting them, they found, to our surprise, they were as good, if not better, than any we had tasted fresh from the shell or out of a can. When the tide had receded enough for us to go to work, we cut up the remaining 2 carcasses and made a cache on the island. A survey from the top of the island showed ice conditions out in the bay towards Framhaven weren't too good, so it was decided to return to the post with the remaining walrus we had kept in the dories, take on provisions and equipment, including Nukupingwa's kayak and his wife Inalungwa, and head for the top of Hayes Fjord on a hunting expedition. Norwhal were supposed to like the feeding grounds in this area, and we would be needing all the meat we could get with over 60 dogs to feed. There was still 24 hours of daylight, and we intended to make the most of it. By the 22nd of August, we were on location and ready to go. Narwhal are scary to hunt, so Nukupingwa would take off in his kayak, and when he made a kill, had only to call in a low voice, as the high sheer walls of the fjord acting as a sounding board, and we would go out in the whaleboat and bring in the bacon. In 7 days of hunting in this manner, with very little sleep, we had 3 large caches containing narwhal, averaging around 1,600 pounds apiece, and ugyuk, or bearded seal, which usually weigh around 1,000 pounds each, as well as a dozen smaller seal, which we shot with a .22. With the caches full, we returned to the post. Akemalingwa, an old man of 70 but still active, the father of our hunter, had been left at the detachment to look after the dogs, so we found everything in good shape. The Eskimos employed at the Bash detachment are Greenland natives from Ita. Permission was requested of the Danish government to hire northern Greenlanders when it was discovered that the Baffinland Eskimos were unwilling to live on Ellesmere on account of the long dark period, which at Bass Peninsula was of 5 months' duration. One native explained it this way: we get the piblucto, which is a polite way of saying it drives them mad. Every minute of favorable weather, we were out with the whaleboat and kayak on the prowl for anything we could use for dog food. When we made a kill, it was customary to head for the nearest point of land and make a cache in the rocks. These caches were numbered, location and contents noted, and on return to the post would be entered in a ledger for future reference. At the detachment were two large blubber tanks, 8 by 6 by 4 feet high. These were kept full for home feeding. After freeze-up, when on the move by dog team, we would pick up food from whatever cache happened to be nearest. On September the 4th, the ice started to form in the bay, and a week later, we pulled our whaleboat out for the winter. The days were beginning to grow shorter, and now there was a mad rush to get all the small jobs that had been holding fire, all the meteorological gear had to be set up, and the record started. It was at this time we discovered we had no calendar. Luckily, Stahl had been keeping his pocket diary right up to date, so there was no question about the day or the date. After bringing the detachment diary up to date, we then made a calendar of our own. In case you are wondering why all the bother about a calendar, I will explain the system we used during the dark period. The first thing we did in the morning was to mark a blue square around the date. And the last thing before retiring, I read X inside the blue square. By using this double check system, we made it without a hitch. It is sometimes a little confusing when it's as black at noon as it is at midnight. As soon as the sea ice was safe to travel, we began conditioning the dogs. In the Eastern Arctic, the dogs are driven fan-shaped, as opposed to the gnome and the tandem hitch of the Western Arctic. The fan-shaped hitch is far more effective for working rough ice. Each dog is on a separate line, usually about 25 feet in length. These are threaded onto a bridle which is fastened to the sled. These bridles are carried in various lengths and are often joined together in order to get the dogs out in the clear when working real rough sections of ice. Practically all the travel on the east coast of Ellesmere is by sea, as the coastline is precipitous and the interior an ice cap 5,000 feet high. In preparing for the period of darkness, we drove the same dogs over the same trail daily. Then, when there was no moon, you hung a lantern on the sled and sat looking backwards. If you could see no sign of the trail, you stopped the team and prospected around until you found it. The sun disappeared at Bash on the 17th of September, and by that time we had things pretty well organized. Stahl could turn out a batch of bread that would make your mouth water. I handled the biscuits and hotcakes, so one thing was certain, we wouldn't go hungry. As the storehouse was packed to the rafters with a good assortment of canned goods. As the days grew shorter, the radio started to pick up. Our best station was Pittsburgh, and all messages, official or otherwise, were relayed through that station. We were always tuned in at 10 p.m. every Saturday. All during the dark period, the reception was good, but during the remainder of the year, it was very poor, to say the least. One of the things we missed at Bass was the Northern Lights. We never saw a sign of them all the time I was stationed there. Another odd feature about this immediate area, no fish, just clams. And I have already told you of the trouble we had in getting a feed of these. The eider ducks had a nesting grounds on three small islands near the mouth of Flagler Fjord, about 5 miles from the post. In the fall, after the main flock headed south, there were usually around 200 or more that elected to remain behind for some reason or other. As the patches of open water grew smaller, we would go up Flagler Fjord by dog team and shoot as many as we could with 22s. Nuka Pingwa had quite a system for retrieving birds in the water. He would flick his 45-foot whip out over the water, and 9 times out of 10, the lash would lay across the body of a duck. He would then draw it gently to where he could reach it. We would bring the ducks to the post, skin them, and stack them like cordwood in a cleft in the rocks for winter use. In October, I started having trouble with my teeth, especially one of the molars in the left upper jaw. One morning I was working outside and it really started to jump. So drastic measures had to be taken. In going through the medical kit, I found a couple of pair of forceps. After gingerly trying them both, I selected the pair that seemed to fit. Setting up a mirror on the table, I sat down, fitted the forceps over the offending molar, and gave a tentative tug. Wow! Have you ever tried to pull one of your own teeth? My advice is don't. Well, it had to be done, so I went to work. Wiggle, twist, then pull. After a minute or so of this, I found the solution. By resting my front uppers on the corner of the table, I was able to apply enough pressure and out it came. Boy, what a relief. The tooth had appeared sound as a dollar whilst in my jaw, but after it was removed, the cause of all the discomfort was readily apparent. From the back at gum level was a hole about the size of a pin halfway through the tooth. It sure felt good to have that tooth out, but I sincerely hope I never have to pull another. I had to have considerable dental work done on my teeth after my return to Ottawa in the fall of 1931. My dentist stated that, in his opinion, the main cause of all the trouble could be traced to the use of glazier water, which contains no mineral. Traveling during the dark period by dog team is quite an experience. We ran short trap lines, being allowed to trap for souvenirs. By doing this, both the dogs and ourselves got our exercise. As mentioned before, you hang a lantern from the handles on the back of the sled, and you keep looking backwards to check if your team is keeping to the trail. When the dogs turn in, spread out, and lie down, you know you have reached a set. Most of our sets were in the vicinity of the meat caches we had made during open water. You take your lantern and your snow knife, walk through the dogs straight ahead, and there is your trap. After picking up the catch, if any, and resetting the traps, you return to the sled, hang up the lantern, and sit down. The dogs immediately swing out on the main trail and continue on to the next set. Usually, no word or command is necessary. As a matter of fact, it is so quiet you hate to make a noise. Sometimes the dogs will wander off the trail. And if you are unable to find it immediately, the best plan is to stop the team and, sitting on the sled, start slowly turning in a circle. What you are looking for is called land loom, and usually after a few minutes you will be able to pick up the dark line of the cliffs. It shows up just a shade darker, and if there is no wind, is usually fairly easy to discern if you concentrate. Once you have picked this out, you head your dogs in the desired direction and go merrily on your way. In case you are wondering why we don't use a compass, we are about 500 miles north of the magnetic pole, and they are quite useless. The needle just keeps turning in a crazy circle.